As the men came into her line of vision, Catherine stretched out a thin hand towards George Marvel. He took it, clutching her fingertips gently, shocked at her emaciated bones, at how delicate her hand was. Catherine, later, deemed him so sympathetic. It wasn't just the attorneys who were required in shot. Catherine's friends, too, surrounded her once the lawyers moved away. Charlotte perched on the arm of the sofa at her feet, while the others stood behind. Pearl Payne was in the centre, holding her hand. All the women were looking at Catherine, but Catherine was looking at Tom. He had come forward now that the hearing was over and seated himself by her side. As the camera clicked, the husband and wife had eyes only for each other. Suddenly, a reporter later wrote of seeing Tom and Catherine together, "I forgot her crumbled teeth, the shattered jaws. I forgot the tragic remnants that radium poisoning left of a once handsome woman. I saw briefly, instead, the soul that holds her husband's love, a love grown blind to the fragile shell of a woman that is all other people see." There was just one other photograph. Hearing the meeting was over, Tommy and Mary Jane came running into the room. Tom lifted them up, one in each arm, and sat them on the back of the sofa so that Catherine could see her children. And now, for the first time all morning, she came alive again, reaching out to hold Tommy's hand with an animated expression on her face as she chatted to her boy and girl. Mary Jane had sweet bobbed hair with a ribbon in it and wore a coloured dress. Tommy was in a long white shirt. Both seemed somewhat overwhelmed at all the guests and the photographers, and shortly afterwards Tom ushered everybody out. Grossman and the other girls went directly to a downtown hotel, where they conferred at length before Grossman left for Chicago. The women knew that whatever happened next, it would affect them all. Even that day at the hearing, Majid had confirmed once again that, whatever the judge's decision, the firm would abide by it in handling the other dial painter's claims. With the hullabaloo of the court all gone, Tom shut the door of 520 East Superior Street. Somehow, the house seemed even quieter than it had before the hearing. Now, all he and Catherine could do was wait. Chapter 53. "Spring is in the air," chorused the Chicago Daily Times the weekend after the trial. The newspapers were full of Valentine's adverts for romantic gifts, bridge parties and dances, but there was only one date that the dial painters of Ottawa were keeping, and that was with Catherine Donahue. They found her in good spirits when they called on her. When a reporter, tagging along, asked Catherine what slim thread binds her to life, she replied, "It's the Fighting Irish," with a fond glance at Tom. "I will live," she said determinedly. Doctors had said that she would never leave her bed alive, but she was not done fighting yet. Together, the women prayed for a cure, yet there was no horror among them of death itself. "Each declared," said the Chicago Herald Examiner, "that if the fates decree, she will face the next world with the realization that her sacrifice may have saved others." For the women, somewhat to their surprise, had become poster girls for workers' rights. Already, they had effected a significant change in the law that protected thousands of vulnerable employees and removed a loophole by which corporations could shirk their responsibilities. Inspired by what they had achieved, that same day Pearl Payne wrote to Grossman with an idea.